From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for the 22nd day of November 2017. I'm Todd Gleason. It's Thanksgiving. Coming up in this half hour, we'll hear an interview that Max Armstrong conducted at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention in mid-November with Howard Buffett of the Howard G. Buffett Foundation. He hails from Macon County, Illinois.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our afternoon session. I think you're going to find it very interesting and a great discussion of agriculture coming your way. We call it a deep dive into the world of agriculture with Mr. Howard G. Buffett. You're going to find out a lot about this multifaceted gentleman over the next few minutes. And I must say it's been such a privilege for me to know him, oh, jeepers, what, 25 years or so, I guess, now that I think about it. And I'll keep my mouth shut. I want to introduce Kristen Parman with the Livestock Marketing Association. Kristen, are you here? Oh, yeah, sponsor of this session. Please come up for the introduction of Mr. Buffett.
Good afternoon, everyone. Livestock Marketing Association is very proud to be sponsoring this afternoon's event and the honor of introducing Mr. Buffett. LMA member livestock auction markets found in rural communities all over the country are not only an important piece of the livestock industry, but they are also important to rural vitality. Livestock auctions provide buyers and sellers a local place to do business and in turn contribute value-added dollars to the community. The study of a standard fixed facility auction market in a rural community of 5,000 people resulted in approximately $1 million in total value-added dollars going back to that community. It is because of the auction's commitment to rural vitality and their role in the beef supply chain that I am honored to introduce our speaker. Howard G. Buffett is chairman and CEO of the Howard G. Buffett Foundation, one of the largest private charitable foundations in the United States. He manages or operates farms in Arizona, Illinois, and Nebraska, two ranches on the Arizona-Mexico border, and one farm on the Texas-Mexico border. Mr. Buffett currently serves as sheriff of Macon County, Illinois, completing a vacancy until December of 2018. He also serves on the corporate board of Berkshire Hathaway Incorporated and previously served on the boards of Archer Daniels Midland, Coca-Cola, ConAgra, Lindsay, and Sloan Implement. He has worked in business, held elected office, and earned numerous honors over the years for his leadership and contributions to agriculture, conservation, philanthropy, and journalism. Mr. Buffett has traveled to over 150 countries and authored 8 books, including the New York Times bestseller, 40 Changes, Finding Hope in a Hungry World. To learn more about Mr. Buffett, you can find his extended bio on page 6 of the convention program. And Max, I think with that, I'll hand it back over to you.
Thank you, Kristen.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it. Appreciate your sponsorship of the session of NAFB. There is a new sheriff in town. You heard that expression.
Well, and Max, I'm going to tell you something. When I was appointed, some people said I bought my way into the sheriff's office, and I tell you, after 2 days, those same people would be figuring out how to buy their way out, because I'll sell you a jail if you want one. I tell you what.
You know, I was, I remember we talked about this probably 5 or 6 years ago, and I learned then you had a bulletproof vest, and then I learned how many hours, how many hundreds of hours you've spent on a squad car. Talk with us a little bit about your interest in law enforcement. How did it develop, and why are you such a supporter of law enforcement?
Well, those are kind of two different questions. I'll answer them both. The way I got involved in law enforcement was it's like everything I've done in my life. It was unplanned. So we had just bought a farm in Arizona, and Charlie Jordan was down running a scraper, and I was running a bulldozer, and Tracy Coleman was running the track hoe. And we were building a road, and they didn't need me all that often with the bulldozer, so I jumped in the truck, and I thought I'd drive around the neighborhood. It was all pretty new to us, and it was about 6 years ago. And so I'm coming back, and I up what's this road called Kansas Settlement, and see a deputy sheriff sitting on the corner, and I wave to him. And before I know it, after I turn back on the rock road, I see his lights, and he's right on my tail, and I pull over, and comes up. He's a pretty big guy, and not real friendly, and he says, let me see your driver's license and proof of insurance and your registration. And I was in a black Raptor with Illinois license plates in Arizona. So I hand that to him. And now today I know he was really pretty much messing with me because he sits back there for like 20 minutes, you know. And he could have known what he wanted to in five. Mm-hmm. So he comes back up and he says, well, Mr. Buffet. And I said, it's Buffett. And he looks at me like, I don't really care. And I thought, I just need to keep my mouth shut. And then he says, I don't know how they do this in Decatur. And I said, it's Decatur. And I said, why did I say that, you know? And he says, you know, I really don't care where you're from. And I said, oh, yes, sir. And he continues to be a little bit abrupt and gives me my stuff back. And I'm just, at that point, I'm not asking any questions or anything. I just want to leave. And he says, you want to know why I pulled you over? I said, yes, sir. He says, you're a suspicious-looking vehicle. And I thought, he can't pull me over for looking like a suspicious vehicle. I have to do something wrong, you know? So it really kind of irritated me. So I came back to Illinois, and I knew the sheriff pretty well, Tom Schneider, great guy. And I said, Tom, don't they have to have, like, probable cause or something like that to pull me over? And I told him the story. He says, well, you want to learn more about it, I can put you in an auxiliary program. You got to complete the range and the liability testing, the law, and all that stuff. And I said, hey, I'll do that. So that's actually how I got interested in it, involved in it. Now, there is a second part, which why am I so interested in it and stayed interested in it? We've worked in about close to 90 countries around the world. And I would say most everywhere we work the most are places that have either come out of conflict or are in conflict. And the rule of law is what's missing. So people will say, well, how are you going to fix hunger? How are you going to fix poverty? How are you going to fix whatever it is that, you know? And the truth is, you can do programs on everything you want to do. At the end of the day, if you don't have rule of law, you will have police officers that take bribes. You'll have congressional members or mayors or whoever it is that will not do the job they're supposed to do. So that leads to a whole cascade of things that then people suffer from. And so that conflict can't be in existence if you have rule of law. And so rule of law has become something that's been pretty important to me, and it's become more important. I know we might talk about it later as we've seen what happens down on the border with our ranches and farms.
But let the record show, you don't just sit behind a desk in the Macon County Courthouse. You shared with me a few minutes ago, you were involved in a hostage situation the other evening, yeah. Very much involved in it for 7 or 8 hours.
Yeah, that happened actually.
There's some tough situations.
Yeah, it happened a week before I got sworn in for the vacancy, but I was with the current sheriff then, and it was one of our officers. You don't think about what you're doing when you're doing it, because you just do what you think you need to do. And it was really hard for us to watch one of our own guys put himself in that position. And I hope it turns out okay for him. But it was 9 hours of hell, to be honest with you.
I can imagine. The border.
Yeah.
What should we know about it? Many of us, it's a very distant situation for us. What we hear is filtered through the media. You've had a front row seat down there for that.
Yeah, but I'm going to guess that it's not as distant as you think. I realize the group that's sitting in here might not run into it quite as often, but we did a little study once and we found that all 50 states, including Hawaii and Alaska, to be honest with you, are using illegal immigrants for agricultural production, okay? And so what we've learned, we bought our farm in Arizona for two reasons. One was to move all of our research activity out of South Africa back to the U.S., and the big joke was Doug, who runs that, you know Doug, he kind of fell in love with South Africa. I said, well, yeah, but if you're in Arizona, you know, you're back in the United States. I mean, think how great that'll be. So I get him moved to Arizona, and the first thing he says to me when I see him is he says, you realize you can't even get Saturday delivery Federal Express here in Wilcox, Arizona. And his implication was South Africa wasn't so bad, you know, but anyway, so... But we also bought it because I wanted to actually go through the H-2A program. And my gosh, that is a disaster. And so we went through that for several years, and that's another story. But on the border, we have two ranches on the border and a farm that are in Arizona and a farm in Texas on the with 3/4 of a mile Rio Grande River frontage. And we pump out of that river for irrigation. So we have people coming across those pieces of land on a regular basis. If you took those three pieces of land, there's probably not a single day somebody isn't crossing one of them, okay? And it's different in all places, but, you know, in the San Rafael Valley, it tends to be what the Border Patrol would call UDA, which is undocumented aliens, and high-end drugs, heroin, coke, you know, what they will take. I mean, a lot of that stuff goes through the ports of entry. And then on our other ranch between Naco and Douglas, you will see a lot of marijuana coming across, a lot, big, big bales, anywhere from 50 to 80 pounds. And it's on a regular basis. And across from our ranch by Naco, we have a guy that sits up there on the Mexican side on a hill, I call it a hill on steroids, about 700 or 800 feet above elevation. He's got a spotting scope, night vision. He's got a, they built a little building up there. He stays there. They trade off, but I mean, they're up there 24/7 and they're just calling out on radios, telling their guys how to avoid law enforcement, whether it's Border Patrol or DEA or the local sheriff's office or whoever it is. So we've seen a lot of activity down there, and it's really made me aware of the fact that if you look at the kind of corruption along our border on both sides, and the threat that it really gives long-term to this society in terms of the opioid crisis and the violence that goes with it in our cities, it's everywhere across this country. There's not, if you think you're living somewhere where this is not happening, you're wrong. And it's different than people, it's different than how I grew up thinking about it, okay? It's not, you know, some, you know, homeless person in a, you know, burned out building, living on an old mattress that, you know, is shooting up heroin. I mean, I have met four or five people in my community in Decatur, Illinois, that are, the parents are attorneys or they're human resource officers at large companies. I mean, they're your neighbors. And the way this is developed is really a scandal because, how it got started in terms of prescription drugs and how that expanded. But the drug cartels have seized on this, and they are bringing in more and more drugs every year, and they're getting more clever about how they do it. If we, you know, are able to put pressure on them on the physical border, they'll find other ways to bring it across. But it's a fight, and it's a fight we have to care about, because if I'm China or Russia, I'm not going to come invade you. What am I going to do? I'm going to figure out a way to erode your society from the inside out. Drugs are going to do it.
Have you had security issues on your ranch?
We've had some visits from the cartel. One of them made me pretty nervous.
Really? What was the nature of that?
Well, they show up in an all blacked out vehicle, sit outside your driveway, and I just happened to have six guys with me. We were all armed, and I think they probably, you can't tell what they're doing. My guess is they are looking at us, checking us out, and they decide to turn around and leave. But we're a little different because they know we're associated with the sheriff's office, and they know that my guys that are down there are former law enforcement. Believe me, they know who's there. And it's not unusual. This has not happened to us, but it does happen to other people we know. You know, it's not unusual. If one of my guys was sitting having coffee in the cafe in Bisbee, you know, somebody comes up, sits down, says, "Hey, Max, how are you today?" And you're looking at this guy going, "I don't know this guy." "Max, how are the kids? They still going over to the elementary school on 9th and Wilson, you know, or whatever it is. Wife still shopping at Kroger's or Safeway or, you know, whatever it is." And you're sitting there going, "What the heck?" And, you know, then this guy starts kind of talking to you. You know, maybe you can help us out. And anybody who thinks that that's not true is leaving. They don't understand it. We have quite an elaborate camera system set up. And if you were to look at some of what we have, I'll just put it this way. There are people, probably some of them U.S. citizens, that come from the north to recover some of the drugs that get dropped when the smugglers run. I mean, it's a whole nother world down there, Max. It's a whole nother world. But it doesn't, it's not, the border isn't where it stops. It's where it begins. So if you want to know what's going on in Chicago, you know, and all these shootings, and there's 100 other places like it, you know, that violence is driven by drug distribution and fights over turf. And what happens is it escalates because you start there. And then these guys get wound up, and they get weapons, and they get more attitude. And so then somebody puts on Facebook that, you know, your girlfriend's ugly, and now they're going to do a drive-by shooting. So, and that is what happens. So it fuels a lot of the violence and misery that's happening in this country, and I think people don't connect the dots.
What will the wall do?
Well, there are places where physical barriers make a significant difference. And there's probably some miles where we should have more than we have. But you can't put a wall up between two countries that are best trading partners. We can never solve the issue on the border without Mexico as a great partner. I mean, my feeling is that there's a way you treat people who you need as partners, and you don't treat those people with derogatory statements and trying to run them in the ground. You can dislike what they do sometimes. You can think they don't work hard enough at certain things regarding the border, but the only way you're going to improve the relationship is to work with them, not work against them. So, you know, the idea of some wall and the Mexicans are going to pay, and Mexico's going to pay for it, it's not a good idea, and it's not going to happen.
You're a farmer.
Yeah.
How did all that start?
Well, I have a temporary time out now, but anyway, yes, but I will be back.
It's kind of like Sonny Perdue. He took time out to be a governor,
well,
he said,
you.
And now
yeah.
he's back in agriculture.
But he's sorry he did that, too.
So how did this agriculture interest start? Did you and your father ever have any discussions about agriculture when you were a young man?
Well, when I was 19, I literally did not know the difference between soybeans and corn. And I would bet that he's smart enough, he probably could figure it out, but he doesn't really know. This is another crazy story. I'll try to make it quick. But so I was in the excavating business. When I was young, I always wanted to have a bulldozer and move dirt, and I just loved doing it. And it was one of the few things I was actually pretty good at naturally. So I went out and borrowed the money and bought a 955K bulldozer. Anybody in here knows anything about it? It was a 61H series. And I went and bought it from this guy, Earl Gruen, and he says, go on out and jump up and start it up. Well, I didn't know how to start it up. So, I knew nothing. So I said, oh, Earl, it's your machine. You go ahead and start it up. Then I watched him, and, you know, I knew how to run it once it got going, but I really didn't know how to start it. So I ended up buying this machine. Well, long story short, I ended up wanting to have a trailer to haul it around. So I contracted with this guy to build a trailer because I was too cheap to buy a real trailer. You know, that was one lesson I learned. Sometimes, you know, you're just better off to do it the right way. So this guy, Harry Sorensen, was going to build me the trailer, and I gave him the money up front. That was another lesson I learned, is you don't give everybody all the money up front, okay? I was a slow learner, Max. My dad was going, man, I didn't teach this kid very well, did I? And so anyway, I go to get the money back, because like 6 months later, I don't have the trailer. And he says, I don't have the money. I spent it. But I'll tell you what, I'll give you a Minneapolis Moline 5-star tractor instead. Well, that sounds okay. He brings it over, drops it off. I'm going, what the heck am I going to do? This is like ancient, you know. It's like from 1958. And it won't start. And, you know, I mean, all this. So then I asked a farmer friend of mine, Otto Wenz. He lived not too far away. I said, Otto, he had all these Minneapolis Molines and Olivers and he's the guy that had the old 60-30 tractors with no cabs, you know. And I said, can you fix this? Well, he knew how to fix it without spinning. You know, I got the parts list from, by then it was owned by White. And I got the parts list, and they had a big distributor in Omaha. So I went down there and got all that. It was like $3,800. He says, no, I can fix this for you for nothing. He says, I'll just take the ampli-torque converter out, and I'll weld two shafts together, and it'll work. I said, that's fine. So then I said, whenever you need something, let me come down and help you out, grade the road, whatever. So he calls me up one day. He says, hey, I need somebody to run a tractor. So I go down there and I start running the tractor. And I go, hey, I like this. You know, this is better than digging basements. So I got interested in agriculture because of that. I mean, that is what started me. And then I had some great friends, Francis Kleinschmidt. Could never have done it without him. And, you know, one day after I decided to rent some property, we're on this 40-20 with an old four-row 494 planter, and we're planting, and he stops, and it's a Sunday morning about 11 o'clock, and he jumps off. He says, okay, you got to finish planting. And I said, how am I going to do that? I don't know how to do that. He says, I got to go to a wedding in Hardington. You're going to figure it out. You've been watching me for 2 days. Now you have to do something. And I got on it, and I would break something, but I have to figure out, I'm not that mechanical. I was mechanical enough, but, you know, and that's how I learned. And, I look back at some of those things, and I think, why in the world did I ever think I would get through that, you know? But I did. But and I just love farming. I mean, I love every bit of it. And my son farmed with me for 5 years. And this is the first year he's not farming in Nebraska. He got too busy. And so I will never give it up. You know, I'm a temporary leave of absence now. But actually, I have a general coming from Columbia on Friday, and we saved 20 acres over in Illinois. We saved 20 acres so he could run the combine, because he's told me I run a tank, I run a, you know, all this different stuff. And I said, well, you ever run a combine? He said, no, that's when I was down there. So he's going to come. And I find that getting people on the farm is one of the best experiences you can give. You know, they don't really have any idea. They just don't. And I realize it's not the old, you know, the pitchfork and those two famous, you know, the mom
you like and pop. You like the technology, clearly.
I love it.
You've loaded
yeah,
up on it.
I love doing it, yeah.
Talk about
it. It's better than working hard, Max. Yeah. I mean, you know.
But you've embraced the technology and your equipment. I mean,
I think that's some of the coolest stuff there is. I think one of the challenges we have as farmers is making sure that what we invest in pays. And I think that we're also held hostage a little bit. You know, I'm one of those guys that, you know, you cut me and I bleed green. I mean, I'm a John Deere guy all the way through. But you know, I argue with them about, you know, if I'm going to buy 7 receivers and, you know, 7 GS, well, they're probably GS3s, the old ones now. But, I mean, you know, I should get a discount or something. Well, I'm not getting a discount. Nobody else is. So, I mean, I argue with those guys a little bit when I can. But, you know, the technology has made it much more efficient. But I don't think we should confuse efficiency with competitiveness.
Elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, I don't think we're very competitive in the world today as farmers, and many people would look at me and go, what do you mean by that? But I think that we have, I wrote this down because I knew I wouldn't remember it. So I looked at this a little bit as if I was buying a business, and I thought, okay, what are some of the indicators? What are some of the things I might think about? And in the last 25 years, the price of Illinois farmlands increased 400%. My corn yields increased 60% that same period, okay? Now, those are USDA numbers. So when I say mine, I mean, I hope I beat the USDA numbers a little bit. But average cost of bag of corn, and this is what really gets me as a farmer, okay? 410%. My average price of corn increased 107%. If I'm a businessman and I've got all these other expenses, and not just normal inputs like anhydrous or, you know, DAP or some of the other things that, you know, we're all buying, you know, when I look at some of those things and compare them, I think, how can I remain competitive, you know, in that environment? And so, you know, you may be competitive with your neighbor because you're doing something better, but that's not who you need to be competitive with. You need to be competitive on the world market. So, you know, if you look at that, I'm sure everybody read that article in the Wall Street Journal a few weeks ago, and it said that 3/4 of America's cropland is controlled by 12% of farmers. I think there's some unintended consequences from that. I think one of them is our congressional representation. I think we're going to find that we mean less over time, and I think we're going to have a harder time, much more difficult time getting people to care about our political representatives caring about us, because our vote doesn't count so much anymore, okay? That's pretty simple, really. And then I think, you know, we have been able to exist in a certain way as a community, as farming and as an industry. So when I look at what it does to the industry and the image of our industry, you know, if people are reading an article and the guy has the vacation home in 3 places and a cabin and whatever else, they're thinking, well, what's he need everything that we do? And I'm going to get to what we do in a minute, because people love to say, well, we don't get subsidies. I want to make an argument that we get a lot of subsidies, okay? Because they come in a lot of different forms and a lot of different flavors, okay? It doesn't have to be a check that's handed to you in the mailbox. And, you know, if you look at the community, you know, and I'm one of those guys who looks at local businesses, I look at schools, I look at families, and I look at all that, and I think, is this really the direction we want to go? And it's not the direction I would want to go. So then I ask the question, what's the driver behind that? The driver becomes, are you competitive? It's not a question of whether you're efficient. Because if efficiency doesn't equal competitiveness, then you're making a mistake in how you're looking at it and how you're analyzing it. So I made this little list, and I quit making it, but I looked at this. Okay, this is what people miss, in my opinion, sometimes. We have a water transportation system that took billions of dollars. We have a road system that took billions of dollars. We have crop insurance program, okay? If we were farmers and we didn't have crop insurance program, we couldn't afford crop insurance, okay? That's a huge deal. That is underwritten by our federal government, all right? We have tax deductions. Everybody can say, what do you mean tax deductions? Well, we get sales tax exemptions from all over the place across the board when we buy equipment. We got a Schedule F. If you look at the advantages of what you put down on income on a Schedule F and control, you know, compare it to other schedules or other ways of counting your income, we get a big advantage. Farm commodity trade programs, loans, CRP, grants, research, international marketing system, emergency assistance, CRP, beginning veteran farmers assistance, export guarantees, MAT program, EMT program, TASC program, you didn't know we had all these, the LRP program, the Food for Peace, Food for Progress, EQIP. You can go down, that's half of what I have written down. Those all count, okay? They all count. So we are getting the benefit in some form of that. You go to many other countries. Now, the EU, they make us look like amateurs sometimes, okay? But if you take them out, and if you take Brazil, and particularly, and you start breaking down some of the same things I've listed here that those farmers get there, they're getting a lot of subsidies also, okay? But you take the rest of the world, they're not. And, you know, nobody in Ghana or Nigeria or even South Africa gets no subsidies. I mean, we farmed there for 12 years. It's tough, okay? Now, we were doing research, so we were fortunate. We were trying to make a living. But we are not competitive on a global world scale. And I think over time that hurts us. We've lost something close to 25% of our exports to Africa. Africa's not a huge market for us anyway. It should be a huge market, but we're going backwards. And it isn't because of trade barriers. It isn't because they can't pay for it. I mean, some of those things come into factors in different countries, so I'm not saying that they're not existing. But we've lost a lot to the EU. We lost a lot of rice to Thailand. I mean, if you break it down and look at it, that's a competitive issue. So when we sit here, I tell you what happens, I think, in anything that you do, is you become a bit insular. So in the farming community, attorneys, medical, I mean, I don't care what industry you're in, you tend to look at it in a kind of an insular way. And when you can step back out of that and analyze it in a broader context, that's when you start trying to figure out, you know, how do I become more competitive, or what are we doing that isn't efficient, or what are we doing that we need to change, those things. I think American farmers are one of the most efficient farmers in the world. Now, people will argue that point in a different way, and I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about that, but I still think we're extremely efficient, and I think we are, you know, we have a great community, and I think farmers are by nature in many ways some of just the best families and best people in the world. That's why I hate to see it starting to slip away, because I think this country needs that fabric. I think this country needs more of the best of what we have to offer our country. We need more, not less. And so it bothers me. I think it's the wrong direction.
I know several of you have questions for Mr. Buffett, and we'll pass the microphone momentarily. Someone raise your hand and we'll get a microphone to you. I see Jack Block back there, former Secretary Block. Good to see you, sir. Glad to have
Man,
you here.
Man, if I knew he was here, I'd have been more careful what I said.
Well, you know, some of those subsidies. I'm sorry, Jack.
I'm just going to say, I was listening to you. I still value so much that one book that you put together with all kinds of pictures of beautiful farm scenes and stuff. But I read and listen to you all the time. That's why I'm listening now. But I'm not going to sell my farm anyway, no matter what you just said, okay?
Well, that's good. I don't want you to sell it.
I know. Okay.
Some of those subsidies you mentioned have real tangible benefits for others other than farmers.
I mean, absolutely.
For the taxpayer.
Absolutely.
Food for Peace program you mentioned.
But you need your congressman to be able to understand that and vote the way you need him to vote to support that. Absolutely, they have benefit. I'm not saying they only benefit farmers by any means. They benefit our entire country, and they benefit other countries, for sure.
Mr. Ward down there at the end has a question from WLDS Jacksonville, Illinois. Roger.
Thank you for being here. If the subsidies make us uncompetitive, what's your solution to the situation, and how does a farmer stay in business without those subsidies because the market doesn't give us the prices to be profitable?
Yeah, it's always a trade-off. First of all, I'll tell you how I would define competitiveness, okay? And then I'll tell you that we have this great system called the capitalistic system, which I believe in, okay? So you can't, you don't get to say this is how I want to see it happen. It's going to happen the way the process plays out in a system when you have the kind of freedoms and options that you have, which I think are extremely valuable, and I wouldn't want to live in any other system. But if you want to define competitiveness, then you have to say, two things to yourself. One is, what would I pay for a piece of ground? What would I buy 80 acres for in Illinois or Nebraska or anywhere else if I had to pay for that, like I had to pay for it any other business, how they had to pay for it, okay? So my $10,000 an acre land in central Illinois, or $9,000, you know, depending on what it sells for in an auction today, you know, is probably worth $2,000. If you want to value, I haven't done that valuation, but I'm just guessing. But if you want to value it and make a fair profit, pay for a decent living for your family, you know, how do you really make that work day in and day out? And you can't do that on $10,000 an acre land at $3.50 corn, okay? So, you know, we're going back into a scenario that we all saw in the 80s, and it's not going to be the same. So I'm not predicting at all that it's going to turn out the same way or look the same. But it's a challenge for farmers, and that's why you see consolidation. So I don't think there's anything you can say or do that's going to change it. I'm not advocating for any kind of legislation that says this is what you have to do or you can't do. I'm just telling you that over time, that makes it very difficult to be competitive. I'm all for taking care. I sign up for crop insurance, okay? So, you know, I'd be crazy not to as a farmer. So, you know, I'm not saying those are bad things. I'm just telling you people need to realize that there are significant factors that go into the entire system as you look at it that prop up agriculture in this country. And that's fine if it never changes and we can still find enough markets to sell to. I mean, you know, we may be fine, but I don't know. That's not a really comfortable position to be in if you want to look long term. And I think one thing that's happened that I think is very disappointing is, you know, there's a couple reasons. My son told me last year, I don't want to farm. You know, I've done it 5 years. I'm going to do something different. That has happened across this country over and over and over. If those kids felt that they had the same kind of respect and opportunity and could really make money, then I think less of them would make those decisions. If you're competing, if somebody goes to school and graduates with a degree and you can get $120,000, you know, you're looking, and my entry salary may be $70,000 or $80,000 or something, but if I'm looking and I think I can get to $120,000 in 4 or 5 years for, you know, some big ag company, am I really going to go back to the farm, take the risk, borrow the money, end up in a situation that I can't predict, okay? Or do I want to go on and do something different? So I think that, you know, identifying the fact that we are not as competitive as we think we are should help us make better decisions. I don't think it's something you do overnight. I don't think it's something that you do through legislation or anything else. I just think that, you know, but I think you have to be aware of it. And if we walk around thinking that our $10,000 an acre land is really worth $10,000, it is if somebody will pay for it. I get that. But, you know, it's probably part of the reason why my son doesn't want to farm, to be honest with you.
So Howie didn't really think there's that potential on down the road that he felt.
No, and he also, I mean, we're not a very big farm in Nebraska, you know, and so that would have something to do if we were farming 3,000 or 4,000 acres there or something, you know, like we are in Illinois, you know, it might, you know, he might look at it differently if there was. I mean, I know that he loved doing it, and his wife, you know, is from a farming family, and, you know, the first thing he asked me when he said I wasn't going to, you know, I don't think I want to continue to farm. I was a little afraid I was going to get upset with him, and I didn't. I wouldn't. I mean, you know, he needs to do what he wants to do. But the first question he asked me, he says, now, you know, as soon as Thomas is old enough, that's his son, he says, he can come ride the tractor, right? I said, of course he can. You know, but I, you know, he doesn't want to give that up either. There's a connection in agriculture that honestly I don't see where you get that almost in anything else you do.
Jason, I think Phyllis has a question here. I saw her raise her hand. Please identify yourself if you would.
Phyllis Parks from WITY in Danville, Illinois. And I want to go back to what you talked about in the beginning about the wall. I can understand that part. But I just saw a sign the other day that said there's 144 overdose deaths of drugs
a day,
which makes it close to 60,000 deaths a year. So, and I know the Border Patrol is having a horrible time down there controlling all of this. So other than a wall, do you have any other suggestions that you think might help reduce this? Because Illinois is horrible, as you know, Chicago and everything. We just have a big problem in Illinois, too, and especially in Danville.
Well, actually, in Illinois, you're right, we do. In Illinois, if you go, if you stay kind of east of the Mississippi, you have a whole different distribution network. And if you look in Nebraska and you look in California, you're going to find that meth and crack cocaine, and those are their big issues. They haven't even gotten to the real opioid problem that we've seen east that's moving west. The first thing we need to do, and I really believe this, is the DEA needs to be empowered to go after the corporate executives, okay, the distributors and the people who helped create this problem. And I'll tell you why, because it's the only way we're going to get enough money. I mean, we need a tobacco-type settlement out of the pharmaceutical companies and the distributors. And I'll tell you why, because it's going to take billions of dollars to educate people, for to be able to put people through rehab, because if they're not in rehab, they're in the jail. I can tell you about that. I've learned a lot about that in the last 2 months, okay? The jail is a dumping ground for mental illness and for drug addicts, okay? We can't change anything if they're in our jail, all right? Where are we going to get the billions of dollars that it's going to take for rehabilitation? And a lot of these kids are great kids, and they could be yours or mine. And, you know, you can't give up on people. So, you know, if we don't go after that, both for punishment and discouragement and for money, then we're making a huge mistake, and we don't have time to waste. That is something that ought to be happening right now. Then we do need to look at some of the things on the board. I'm writing a book on this, believe it or not. I said I'd never write another book. Don't write a book.
On the border, right?
Yeah. I've got all my solutions in there, and my publisher will fire me if I give them to you. Oh. But I do have five different chapters on what I would do differently down there. And, you know, there's no magic bullet. There's no silver bullet. There's no way that you can just simply change this. But I will tell you that if we don't, if we are not able to do two things, if we're not able to work with Mexico in a way that we've never worked with them, okay, we've never had the kind of partnership we need. We have to have that partnership. They have to accept us, and probably the Colombians would be a huge advantage, into their country to help them. This is a war. If you know what's going on in Mexico, there was a study that came out a few months ago that said other than Syria, Mexico is the most deadly place in the world. Okay? Don't go to Acapulco for vacation anymore, because they kill people there and they bury them there. And I'm serious. I could give you a site on the internet that you would not want to look at. It's hundreds of videos that are put up by cartel members. The violence and the death that is going on in Mexico is unbelievable, okay? They need our help, but they're not going to ask somebody to help them who they feel have been incredibly offensive to them, okay? I get that. We have to change that. The second thing we have to change is, you know, it's almost funny when the administration comes on and says, well, we're going to export all those MS-13 guys back to El Salvador. Guess what? A whole lot of them are U.S. citizens. You're not exporting them anywhere, okay? Second of all, the more you export down there, the more people are going to come here. You don't fix anything, okay? And so those are great words to spew out. They sound good. You know, they get certain people that care about certain things politically all riled up. They like it. The honest truth is it's hard work. It's long-term strategies. It's partnerships with countries that need our help. So we can look south of our country and say that's their problem. Why do you think we've had an immigration problem for the last, particularly the 10 years have been unbelievable, 15 years? Because those people are struggling. I never would use the word refugee before for somebody coming to this country from the south. And I can't really tell you why. I guess it's just my expectations of being in the United States. I've been in 20-some refugee camps across the world. The truth is what's happening south of us is no different than the refugee camps I've been in Darfur or Cameroon or Yemen. I mean, you know, people's lives are being threatened. If we're going to treat that as we're going to just send MS-13 back home, it's not going to solve anything. So, you know, we have to be willing to look at a bigger picture and embrace those countries as partners with somebody who shares a problem with us. They share a problem with us because their problem is our problem. And you're not going to build a wall and say, it's not our problem. That won't happen. It won't work.
Gail, I think the microphone is right there for you. Please identify yourself, sir.
Yeah, we're cutting up. Wixie Classic out of Champaign, Illinois. Howard, good afternoon.
Oh, you're getting too close to home now. Okay.
Howard, we've talked before. You talk about competitiveness. And I'm really curious, with your connections worldwide, of where we are on trade right now, such an important part of being competitive in agriculture. What do you feel like that we are now from the United States stance on trade right now in regards to agriculture and other manufactured products like the D8s or something like that?
Secretary Block could answer that better than I can. And I'm serious, he could. I can't give you a great answer on that, but I am going to give you one little insight based on your question. We were in El Salvador and went to a manufacturing plant, and it's a very proactive management, but it's owned by the U.S., by a U.S. business. And they employ a lot of former gang members, and they put them through school. So we met with the guys who own it in the United States and told them how impressed we were with what they were doing, trying to figure out how some of our charitable efforts in El Salvador could you know, kind of blend in with what they were trying to do. And they told us that they lose more people in a month in the United States at their plants than they do than they lose in a year in El Salvador because of drug testing. So that's another issue. How do we remain competitive overall as a country if we do this to ourselves? But I also think about, you know, trade is a two-way street. And this will really irritate some of my friends, but I'm good at doing that. You have a back door I can sneak out. The one thing I know pretty well is sugar. Whether it's being on Coca-Cola's board or whether it's been on the ADM board, which is kind of two different parts of the argument, we have taken a commodity there, and because of the way we've set up the trade on that commodity, we have destroyed one of the most pristine, or parts of one of the most pristine wetlands in the world. We have supported one of the most slave labor intensive industries in the world, and that's so we can have cheaper products. So when I think about trade, I don't think about how is the American farmer sell more corn in Botswana or something, you know, where they don't buy much corn. I think about, and this is probably because of what I've done the last 20 years with our foundation, I think about how does trade impact other people? How does trade impact our ethics? How does trade impact our morality? You know, it goes way beyond just saying, you know, we're going to have some tariffs or we're going to have, you know, whatever. So when I think about trade, I think about it that way. And I know that's not how you're asking the question, but that's how I have to answer it because that's how I look at it. And I think that, you know, over time, you know, as far as I think the direction you're going, and the standard question on trade is that we don't have all the opportunity. I mean, if somebody looks at the world and says, hey, we export 5% of our production to Africa, the continent of Africa or something. I mean, something like that. I don't know exactly. And a lot of that's wheat to Egypt or Nigeria or something. I mean, it kind of warps it. Then I don't see the African continent, number one, as a great opportunity for trade for us, because I don't know how we are competitive in that market, to be honest with you, over time. And you can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't say that you want to sell corn, wheat, soybeans, whatever it is, to all those countries on the continent. Then let me ask you a question. How are they going to thrive? How are they going to develop? How are those farmers going to survive? Because it is a little bit either or in some cases. And so I think when you look at trade, that's why I bring up efficiency and competitiveness. That is going to have a big impact on that. If we continue, you know, one of the greatest disasters that occurred in my lifetime is when the grain embargo was put in place in 77, I think.
The first one?
Yeah.
This is the guy that lifted the second one.
Yeah, uh-oh. All right, see, I keep forgetting you're in the audience, Secretary Block. But we didn't know what was going to happen. It was an unintended consequence. So it's easy to look back, okay? But the way I look at that is you've got this huge guy in the ring, and you get in the ring, and you're the underdog, and you don't even think you can beat him. I mean, you already went in defeated before you thought anything was going to happen. All of a sudden, you won, or you knocked him down once, or you did something. Well, that was the United States. Who could compete with us? Who could go toe-to-toe with us in agriculture? Nobody. But when we did that, you know, we gave Brazil and Argentina and other countries, they were like the little guy in the ring. They went, whoa, maybe we can do something here. We gave them that little glimmer of faith to become the big guys, and they compete with us today like we never thought they would compete back in 1977. Clearly, an unintended consequence. You know, it isn't like anybody, you know, I think, you know, I mean, Secretary Block could tell us this, but looking back, you know, it's like a lot of things in your life. You might have made a little bit different decision. You might have done something different if you'd have known what was going to happen. But that changed the world of agriculture, as far as I'm concerned. And we have competitors today that, you know, maybe they would have gotten it done some other way. But when they realized that they could be competitors, it accelerated things. It changed things. So we're in an environment where, and Brazil has got some similarities. I mean, they've got overpriced land, and they've got environmental issues, and they've got all these other things going on. So it's not like they just get a free ride, you know, on their end of it either. But I don't see how. I think some adjustments have to be made in what we're used to today to become more competitive in the world. Or we will rely on trade, whether it's tariffs or sanctions or whatever it is, as a way to try to stay competitive. And in the long run, that's not a great way to stay competitive, because it's not very sustainable.
Well, I think Melissa has a question down here, Jason.
Can somebody ask me something to be positive?
Yeah. From KFEQ Radio in St. Joe, Missouri. Not everybody here is from Illinois, just so you know.
Good.
Yes, I'm just an hour north of here. And you were talking earlier about some of the subsidy and other farm programs, and one of them you were mentioning is also comparing us to the EU and how they make us look like children. What are some of the programs that you believe, and you can just pick a couple, maybe some of the big ones that we really need to be taking hints from and that you believe would do well here or that need to be implemented here?
Oh, I think, I mean, I actually think that, I mean, the EU, And I'm not up on everything they've done in the last few years. I just know my visits over there and talking to farmers over there. But so I'm making a pretty broad blanket statement when I say it. But and I'm glad to be corrected if I'm wrong. But I mean, you know, from what I've known historically, that's almost a socialist system in terms of how they take care of their farmers. they have made a decision that they want society and agriculture to maintain certain things that they can't do if they followed kind of the same track we did. So, you know, they're kind of one extreme when it comes to that. I think when I list these programs off, I'm not listing them off because I think they're bad, they're wrong, or we shouldn't have them. I think we have some great programs. I'm a huge believer in the CRP, to be honest with you, as long as it's not politically allotted. And I know it has been in the past at times. You know, it can be very political. That's wrong. But the CRP is a great program. If you're trying to conserve soil and you're trying to take, you know, some land out of production that probably should have never been farmed before, that's a great program. So I think we have some great programs. Look, crop insurance, you know, farming is the most one of the most unpredictable, if not the most unpredictable, industries there is. I look at farming as just as important as the Department of Defense, to be honest with you, because if we can't feed ourselves, we put ourselves in a position that we become very vulnerable. Agriculture is something that should be important. I know why it isn't, because people don't think about it, they don't understand it, but it should be as important to them as maintaining a lot of other things that we maintain, because it is in the betterment and the protection of our society in general. Agriculture fits in that category, 100% in my mind, okay? So the fact that we have crop insurance because our farmers are in a very, you know, unpredictable, precarious situation, you know, I totally believe in that. Now, if we end up having, like I had one guy describe to me, well, at some point, Iowa's going to have 12 farmers farming all of Iowa. Well, then I wouldn't underwrite 12 farmers with crop insurance. I'd tell them that, you know, you can, I mean, that to me sounds like a huge exaggeration. That's going to be 12 farmers, but he was explaining to me how they were going to do it. You know, I mean, then I wouldn't have a crop insurance program. But, you know, if you've got hundreds and thousands of farmers that need to depend on that, and we depend on them, you know, then there's a value in making sure that they can stay in business when there are things that disrupt their business. So I'm not saying those are bad things. I'm just saying people have to realize that we have them. Because I think oftentimes, you know, I was somewhere about a year ago, and I heard a U.S. farmer say to somebody, get very defensive, and say, well, we don't have subsidies. You know, we don't have them like we used to. And it's like, yeah, but, you know, we might need to put a lot of money into our waterway systems, but the fact is we have those waterway systems. The fact is we have unbelievable railroad systems. I mean, those things should make us more competitive around the world, and they probably keep us somewhat competitive around the world, because there's no, on the entire country or continent of Africa with 54 countries, you know, they have nothing like that, zero. So, you know, those are not, like, I'm not saying they're bad things. I'm just saying we have to be realistic about what it is that helps us be competitive and efficient, and how do we look at those things going forward.
Many other industries benefit, in all fairness, from those transportation attributes we have.
Sure they do.
Petroleum,
yeah,
et cetera.
Our good friends in the petroleum business.
Jason, who do you have back there who needs a microphone? Please identify yourself with your question.
Hi, I'm Emily Berger, and I'm a student from Texas A&M University.
Oh, no. I was supposed to go like this or something. I don't know. You beat us in football every year, but anyway. I'm thinking Nebraska, not Illinois, so yeah. Go ahead.
So my question is about global competitiveness also, because you talked about subsidies being something that keeps us from being competitive. But another issue that I'm aware of is the availability of arable land. And you mentioned Brazil several times. And if I remember the number correctly, there's something like 140,000 acres of undeveloped land that could potentially be converted into farmland. And even if
Where?
Only just in Brazil. And not all of that will be high quality.
Probably 140,000 hectares, most likely, but I don't know.
Thank you. I probably...
Well, I'm not sure. I'm just saying, yeah, that would make it more. So.
So my question is, how are we supposed to compete when these other countries have potential for so much more land being developed into farmland, whereas we are expanding cities and possibly losing farmland?
Well, I think one of the biggest challenges in this country is the loss of farmland. And I don't want to sound contradictory when I say I support the CRP, because I believe there is some land that we farm that really... If it's farmed in a conservation manner, it probably can be farmed reasonably well, but a lot of those are hills that get plowed up and disced, and you lose, you know, 12, 15 tons of soil a year. And so that I don't agree with. Brazil is a great example. There's been they've had some better press lately that I don't think they deserve, to be honest with you, about how much better they are environmentally. I will tell you that probably a lot of the hectares that they say can be expanded are, from an environmental standpoint, not acres that I would think should be expanded. I'll just tell you a great example. We were down in the Pantanal, which is, as a photographer, I can tell you, there's somewhere in the world where you can get the best photographs of any animal. I don't care what it is. And, you know, if you want leopards, you go to, you know, Sabi Sans in South Africa. If you want, you know, other animals, there's places to go. But if you want, you know, if you want mountain lions or pumas, you go to Patagonia. If you want jaguars, you go to the Pantanal in Brazil. Okay, there's nothing like it in the world. Nothing even compares, okay? It's usually considered the largest freshwater wetlands in the world unless Botswana has a good rainy season. So when I was flying down there a couple years ago, the amount of farmland that is getting put into production that is going to drain right into that wetland, right into the Pantanal, is getting developed at a fast rate. Not that we don't either, but I mean, so I'm not, you know, trying to be unfair, but the level of chemicals used, the burning, the soil erosion, the things that all affect an ecosystem are, believe me, happening at a pretty accelerated rate. They're going to destroy over time. I don't know whether it's 20 years or 50 years, but over time, they're going to destroy something that doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. So those acres that people talk about, are all acres are not created equally by any means, okay? Are there acres in the Ukraine and Russia, you know, and some other places that I think could be developed without, you know, much environmental impact? Yes. Could they increase productivity significantly? Absolutely. I mean, you know, that's where I think we are, you know, incredibly efficient. You know, do we want to help them do that? Well, I learned that with Nebraska football when they started telling everybody how they had their weight program, and then 20 years later they couldn't beat anybody, you know, because they all adopted the same thing. I don't believe in, you know, handing people what gives you a competitive advantage in any way, shape, or form. So, you know, we are incredibly competitive that way in our efficiency. But if you're talking about expanding land, you know, there are places, I think there's a lot more acres available than some of the estimates. But they are acres that need to be farmed in an appropriate manner, not to do environmental damage, not to affect our water systems. And I think that's something we're going to see in this country. I think our irrigation, whether you're talking the Colorado River system or the Ogallala Aquifer, whatever it is, I mean, those things worry me, I mean, over a long period of time. So, you know, efficiency counts. But if you look just at irrigation, in terms of being competitive and efficient, I don't remember the numbers now, but there's huge numbers in terms of what's still flood irrigated or surface irrigated in this country. If you converted that to drip or pivot irrigation, the amount of acre feet you save in a year, and I just don't remember the numbers, it's mind-blowing. You know, why aren't we doing that? If we're going to subsidize something, let's subsidize something that keeps us competitive in the long run. Let's improve our irrigation systems and save that water for the future. So, I mean, I think there are places where I would stand up and defend, you know, if we're protecting our natural resources, I'm 100% for doing what we need to do to do that. And if somebody wants to accuse us of subsidizing something on behalf of that, that's fine. Those are our resources. We're going to do what we need to do to protect them. So I think it goes all the way across the board.
Another question back there, Jason. Whoever it is, please identify yourself.
Yeah, Howard Hale, KSR Radio in Fort Morgan, Colorado, and then Hale Broadcasting. Question I have, you as a producer, as an agricultural producer, what can you or any other producer do to make yourself more competitive through the practices that you use, make yourself more competitive on a world market?
Well, I can tell you one way we do it, and I was driving, I'm going to say this before I say anything else, I'm driving home yesterday from Chicago with another law enforcement officer, and he's looking at all the fields around, he's looking at the guys working the fields, and he's been around our foundation long enough, he says, you know, I don't understand anymore why that guy's out there in that bean field discing it up. I said, I don't either, but I'm not sure he does either. I mean, he just likes to, he wants to do, he believes there's a reason to do it. I'm not saying, you know, I'm not putting that down that way. I don't want that to come across wrong. But, you know, if we're going to, as a farmer myself, I can tell you my bottom line is better because I no-till. And I use less fuel. I put less hours on my tractor. I don't have to trade them as often. I mean, I can go down the whole list, okay? Plus, I'm saving soil. And ultimately, if I want somebody in my family, you know, to farm that farm in 50 years, that makes a difference, okay? That will make a difference in how productive and how good that farm is. So I think as a farmer, that's one way I can distinguish myself. Now, as my dad used to always joke, and he would say, well, you're in the worst business there is. Well, he wasn't joking when he said that. He said, you're in the worst business there is because it's a commodity, you know? And any business that depends on a commodity, whether it's corn or steel or, you know, something else, rubber, I mean, whatever it is, I mean, those are tough businesses by the nature of how they work. Because as he used to joke, I pull in a semi-truck at 8 a.m., you know, and dump my corn. Nobody says, is that Howie Buffett's corn? Because I'll pay more. You know, so nobody cares. It's a commodity. We're in a business that makes it very hard to distinguish ourselves. That is one reason why commodity organizations like, you know, the Corn Growers and the Soybean Association and those groups, I think, have a very important role to play because they put a lot of effort in to trying to make that distinction about how important these different producers are. And I think they add a lot of value to that. And so that also is a very distinctive difference. You're not going to find a Corn Growers Association in Nigeria. You're not going to find them in, you know, you'll find something in South Africa, but it doesn't amount to really anything. I mean, you know, we have so many things in place today in this country that are phenomenal. And we started back in the 1800s down a path that has been unmatched by almost any other country. Brazil rivals it in some ways, okay, in terms of their research and what they've done in conservation adoption. But they've also surpassed us, I think, in environmental damage. And we have some challenges. I mean, we are fortunate that we're not judged the same way that some other industries are in terms of the impact we've had from nitrates and some other things. I mean, we do not have a great track record in some ways. And we've been able to work through that in ways that some industries wouldn't be able to work through that. It's another reason why I think your congressional representation is critical and that advocacy is critical. And as we erode that over time by the way we consolidate, I see it as a huge problem for us as farmers as a group.
Good point. I saw Wes Spurlock there enjoying your comments, chairman of the National Corn Growers, enjoying your comments about commodity organizations. I'm sure he appreciated that. DeLoss, back of the room over here. DeLoss from Illinois Farm Bureau. If you, boy, hey, Jason, we're going to work you a little weight off there, pal.
Thank you. I was just curious, who's in charge of marketing your commodities?
Oh, don't ask me that. Okay.
Do you have any philosophies, 20%, 40%, anything pre-harvest, anything like
that? Well, I have a couple of philosophies that mean nothing, okay? I mean, one is my dad told me he's pretty smart in business, so I thought I'd listen to him on this one anyway. he would have told me never to farm. But, you know, he said, whatever you do, do it the same way year in and year out. So if you're going to decide to sell certain things at certain times in the year and certain amounts at certain times, do that all the way through. And he's right about that, because in my opinion, because if you start to try to guess at certain things and you start to follow a certain pattern, you know, the law of averages usually wins, okay? So I do that. I try to be consistent in that. The other thing is that the only thing that really scares the heck out of me for the most part is hail. And I try to be a little more brave in my marketing, although I get hail insurance and all that, but you still got to deliver, right? And I had that experience 1 year. And I had it a different way. Second year, when we had aflatoxin in Illinois, that was a disaster. And you start buying, and when that happens, you're going to pay more for what you buy. So it's a really fast way to lose money. I try to look at a price point at a certain point during the year, probably about two or three times. And I've not done this in the last year because I've been delinquent in anything I've been doing on my farm. But typically that's what I would do. And I would sell probably 20, 40, 60 under irrigation. I'm a chicken when it comes to dry land, so I probably wouldn't go past about 40 or 50. But I look at that because I think you have to try to take advantage of some movement. So, you know, when something moves, and I don't know that you want to tie yourself particularly to certain times, but I tend to, because I try to follow the rule of trying to be consistent with what I do year in and year out. There's people who would blow the heck out of that theory and have made a lot more money because they haven't done it that way. So, you know, I'm not a great marketer because I don't follow the markets close enough. That's not what I'm good at. I know a guy who farms pretty big in Illinois who has somebody in their family that are just an unbelievable marketer, and they probably make a lot of money because they're good at that, you know. But if you're not good at it, I think you need a system. If you're good at it, go for it. But I'm not a big gambler when it comes to that.
Let's go back to Mark Oppel, past president of the NAFB. Hey. He's one of Patrick Gotch's employees at RFD. Yeah, right.
Thank you, Max. Yeah, and we are RFD-TV, Mark Oppel, Howard, and we are pleased to promote your foundation on the network whenever we can. You mentioned made a great scenario of what's going on, land up 400% while corn is up 60%. And you said, I'm not predicting anything like the 1980s. I'm not sure I understand what you do see agriculture looking like then. If you're not predicting the 80s, what are you seeing in the future?
Well, I think that I think there's some elements of the 80s that are kind of surfacing a little bit when you start looking at higher loan levels and less payback and some of those things. But I don't study that stuff day in and day out, so I can't really comment on that as any kind of an authority. But I think in the 80s, people were shocked at what happened. I mean, farmers really kind of bought into something that I don't think they're ever going to buy into again, at least not to that level. I think that was driven by a little different motivation. Today, I think you have guys, if they want to get into farming, how do you afford that at $10,000 an acre? But if you want to expand your farm, that's your only option. So you got to borrow a lot more money. When that little short period in there where we had really high corn and soybean prices, I still heard some of these guys go, see, I told you this is going to happen. It's never going to go back to where it was. And I thought, man, you are drinking the Kool-Aid, because it is absolutely going to go back to where it was. It won't ever be exactly the same, okay? So I don't believe in predicting stuff that you just don't know. I mean, obviously that's a prediction, but I do worry about the fact that ground that was so high has not nearly adjusted to the commodity pricing. So you've got a land value. This is my biggest concern. You've got a land value that is not supported by the prices. Okay. That has to cause problems for some farmers. And so why land prices haven't adjusted back down as fast as I would have thought they would have I don't know if I thought they would, but you know, you would hope they would over the last 4 or 5 years. I don't know, but that's a big concern to me, because people will still try to go out. And the other thing that happens is I think it plays right into the hand of that consolidation, is because it doesn't mean the bigger you are, the more money you make. We've seen that happen in several cases, but it does mean that you can buy cheaper in terms of inputs. It means you can make different deals. It probably gives you some advantage. So if you can take that, you can probably buy $10,000 an acre land better than the guy that's farming 1,500 acres and wants to buy the 160 acres next to him. So slowly, it pushes it that direction. The second thing I really worry about, and I'm going to go back to the example I gave on the cost of a bag of corn, is farmers have to know they're getting value. One of the things that really upset me personally was when they went to, what do they call it, yes, thank you very much. You knew exactly where I was going, didn't you? Because I used to be able to do my own farm. See, what happened when you got technology is now I can be my own researcher on my own farm, okay? I can start to learn things I could never learn before, all right? Because I've got mapping and I've got ways now to calculate my yield. And I've got things I had tools I never had before. So I used to be able to decide however I wanted to plant my refuge. And I could test that. And I could try different hybrids. And obviously they were all Roundup ready because that's, you know, was pretty standard. But they weren't triple stack. And I was paying considerably less for them, considerably less. And there are places, and I know there's all sorts of arguments for this different ways, because I've been in this argument with the guys from Monsanto. But, you know, I could see the differences with what I did on my farm. And some of it was as simple as being able to see the differences in what I paid for seed. They didn't like that. So what did farmers do? Farmers looked at what was more convenient. And I get that, but I felt that was a huge mistake. I thought we should keep as much flexibility as we have to test our own, the way we farm ourselves, to be able to do as much on-farm testing as we can do. I don't know that there's any way that anybody can tell me, I don't believe there's any way anybody can tell me, that what I pay for a bag of corn today, that I get that value. Okay, because that's becoming one of our biggest input costs, you know, probably next to nitrogen. And that's the other thing I'm worried about, is the fact that we have lost control to a certain degree of how we control our input costs. And when you lose options, look, I've been on the boards of some big companies. We love it when you lose options. We make more money, okay? That's good for us, but it's not good for you. It's not good for the farmer. So I just think that those couple of areas are going to remain really big challenges for farmers who want to be able to expand and remain competitive within our own, you know, with our own world here.
Steve Bridge over here from Springfield, Illinois. There's another Illinois. We got you surrounded, pal.
We followed you over, Howard, an update, 14,100 an acre in Woodford County 2 days ago.
That's crazy.
So 10,000 is a little low still.
Yeah. Well, I've always been behind, so I mean, you know, but.
A question about your effort at the Farm Progress Show this year to bring Decatur school children to Farm Progress. Why urban kids from Decatur to a farm show, and do you see the need for a better effort to get kids from Eisenhower and from MacArthur High Schools in Decatur interested in ag jobs that are at ADM and Tate and Lyle right there down the street that they probably have no idea about?
Great question, okay. First of all, Brian Byers, who's a radio announcer there at WSOY in Decatur, that was his idea. He did all the work. We didn't do the work. We wrote the check. And we have so many kids in Decatur that wouldn't even know who ADM is or Staley is. And they are the biggest employers in our city. And they have truck driving jobs. They have, you know, janitorial jobs. They have executive office jobs. They have, you name it. It goes across the board. So, you know, they have welding jobs. They, you know, you name it. So there's some of those kids that might be great at welding. There's some of them that might never be great at anything, but they can be great at being a janitor, or they could actually end up being the vice president of a division. I mean, so those kids don't know those opportunities exist. So, but Brian came, when he and I talked about it the first time, He said, we've got to show our kids there's a different opportunity in this city than dealing drugs on the corner and looking up to the drug dealer or looking up to the guy that, you know, is doing whatever it is that's involved criminal activity. And so I said, absolutely, whatever it takes, we're going to support it. So the first effort was to bring those kids to Farm Progress and just show them. And I don't know too many, you know, 12-year-olds who don't think a tractor is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. So you can get their attention, and then you start there. And I'll tell you, Brian came to me and he said, my next idea is to put an FFA class together for both of those schools that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And I said, Brian, that is a phenomenal idea. My son did this in Omaha in a school that I believe it's about 70% for sure minority students. They have an FAA class. They didn't, but they do now. And when he wanted to do this, I thought, you're nuts. This will never fly. And it is so popular that 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, we gave them another, I think it was about $1.5 million to build a building, to expand the program, to hire a couple teachers. It is amazing what that's turned into. And I said, Brian, you need to go meet them and figure out what they did wrong, what they did right. You know, what would you do or not do? I hope that in the next few months, Brian has a program put together with a school district that we can put an FAA program, FFA, sorry. I was in a fight with the FAA. That's another story. I didn't win it either. They threatened eminent domain. Yeah, they have one of those things on our farm, and I didn't win that battle. To take an FFA class and get it into both of those schools and start that program, and that's the next connection. So when the younger kids get there, as they get older, they see. Now, I have an ulterior motive in this because I think that kids today that don't have the opportunity at home to see the leadership, to have the mentorship, to learn how to speak, to learn how to take responsibility, to learn how to see something that turns into something productive and positive, a lot of those kids are missing that. They can get that in an FFA program, okay? What better program is there where they can get that? I don't know one. So we're going to try to do that in Decatur. And I've seen it work in Omaha. It's amazing because I did not believe it could do what it did in Omaha. I did not believe it. And it takes a little different, you know, in Omaha it's grown in a little different directions, but you take those directions. You know, they now teach some entrepreneurship classes. They do some other things. That is the kind of opportunity we have to give our young kids. And we have to figure out how to get them interested in it, how to keep them interested in it, and then how to be productive citizens. And I think that agriculture plays a unique role in that with what you mentioned with the high schools, with the FFA programs. And I think it's amazing. I will tell you that it takes a lot of work. I mean, and some kids are just going to say, you know, I'm not doing that, or that's not cool, or whatever. But you just keep pushing it, and you'll get some momentum. I was really shocked at how it developed in Omaha. I really was. But it just shows you that kids are hungry for something. They want something. Most kids, you know, are good kids if you give them an opportunity to be good kids. If you don't give them an opportunity to be good kids and they get an opportunity to do something they shouldn't do, that's where they end up.
The battle against hunger. Your foundation has worked hard in that area. Do you feel like we're moving the needle at all, or do you feel like you're using a garden hose on a forest fire?
Well, it's a bit of a garden hose on a forest fire. You know, I think if you could take the politics out of, like, you know, the PL 480 program and some of the programs we have that assist around the world, they do play an important role in places. But I remember being in Sierra Leone, going to a World Food Program school feeding program, and two things happened on that visit. One is that a guy came up to me and was really angry, and he said, what do you even start this program for if you can't finish it? And they had changed some funding in Congress. Secretary Block will be familiar with this. And so the next year, Sierra Leone was not getting money for the school fee, or they weren't getting the same amount, and that school was getting cut, whatever it was. And I never forget that, because we show up and, well, we're going to do this great stuff for you. And then, well, you know what? A couple of years later, we just can't do that for you. And most of what I have tried to do personally, I don't want to be that person that shows up and then leaves things in a way that sometimes can be worse than when you showed up or if you didn't show up, okay? And I don't think our country wants to be that way. So I think we need to put, somehow we have to transcend the politics on that, because it is something that is needed in a lot of places in the world. It will not solve hunger. I had an experience in Angola where I went and I saw kids literally dying and being buried because they had had three droughts in a row and they were entering the third one. And I called Jim, he was running the UN World Food Program. He's in Indiana. Anyway, I called Jim and I said, how do we get some emergency help in there? Well, when I ended up understanding how it got identified officially, the medical people that had to come in, the you know what had to happen to identify how you feed those who are malnourished and how they aren't, and how you manage that, and the logistics and the amount of money that it took just for the commodities, and the fact that people would just cook the raw corn kernels if they were starving to death. And I learned a lesson from that it was like, you know, I might be able to do this. First of all, Jim says, we don't have it, and we can't get it to you that fast. We don't have it. But I thought, okay, so let's say that you can take those 18 villages in that area that the tribal chief was in charge of, and you can actually solve their problem that year. You're not solving the problem next year, and you might be able to do it in that one place in Angola, but you can't do it across 54 countries on the continent. You can't. You don't have enough money. You don't have the logistics. You don't have the commodities. You don't have the medical help. You don't have. You just cannot do it. And so, you know, what I learned from that experience was that food assistance is a critical component in conflict, post-conflict, droughts, and certain emergency situations. If you continue it beyond those situations, you're actually doing damage because you're not helping, you know, that country develop their own agriculture. And ultimately, that's the key. And we have a little bit, you know, at some point, we have a little bit of a conflicting interest there. And so ending hunger, to me, is not something that you can say, we're going to end hunger. You're not going to end hunger. You can make progress. And you can decrease people who are malnourished. You can decrease people who don't get enough calories a day. You can decrease, you know, certain aspects of it. But ultimately, we have to decide that it's more important for us to help those countries develop their own agriculture. You can't feed people you can't reach. And believe me, there's lots of places in Africa where we're never going to reach them. At a cost that is reasonable, so you have to help people help themselves as well. Hunger is something that a lot of it is man-made. So those things aren't about agriculture. Some of them are about rule of law. Right. Some of them are about the fact that those farmers can grow food in their field in Sierra Leone and not worry about, you know, what happened, you know, a couple decades ago with RUF, and they come in and they say, you want a long sleeve or short sleeve, and they cut your arm off, depending on, you know, what they decide they want to do. Terrorize an entire country. You know, what difference does it make how successful your agriculture is if your entire country, 85% of the population is affected by that conflict? That country was terrorized. You can't solve that by talking about how are you going to end hunger. You've got to end terror first. And so you know, it's a much bigger job than just ending hunger.
We've kind of gone full circle here, haven't we, coming back to the rule of law and law enforcement. Before you leave, how about a parting message? What would you advise to U.S. farmers in terms of, and you talked about, that connection with Congress and the governmental affairs aspect that is so important. Is there a piece of advice that you can share? And maybe it's not fair to just say farmers, because there are so many other people on the rural routes who have a vested interest in this, as a grain elevator operator, for example, as your Sloan Equipment Company and others.
Well, that's a tough question, Max. I'll bet you don't have an answer for that.
I bet I don't.
No, I look at it, I think, you know, not to sound, you know, sentimental or something, but we have built an incredible agricultural system. And that system means, you know, you're feeding people better. You have grocery stores. You have, I mean, you know, you have transportation networks. You have all these things that are part of that system. It's the most important system that we have in this country. So we all need to think about, you know, how we do our part to support that and communicate that. One of the things that I'm worried about a couple of things. I mentioned it. I mean, I'm worried about our consumption of water for irrigation. That will affect a lot of farmers. Those farmers that are affected then affect parts of that system that touch them. Okay, so I think we need to do a much better job on natural resource conservation, and that's water and that's soil. And we have failed on some of those things in the past, and we need to do better. And if the history doesn't tell us, then we're not learning fast enough, and because we have plenty of examples. So I do think that that's something that all of us need to focus on, whether it's farm broadcasters, it's farmers, it's people buying stuff in the grocery store. They should care about whether or not the guy who grew what they're buying lost 12 tons of soil or lost 2 tons of soil in that year on that farm, because ultimately at some point it's going to affect people. It already is affecting people. So I worry about the conservation aspect of it all across the board. And then I'll tell you one last thing. I think that, you know, this doesn't hit us at home in the Midwest, but we got a real challenge coming in terms of our fruits and vegetables, in terms of labor and how that plays out. And some of those farmers are learning that lesson today in California and Georgia, and even in Michigan. And so when we find ourselves in a situation where Americans don't want to do the work, and I can argue that all day long, if someone wants to say that people are taking their jobs away, that is not true, okay? And I can argue that all day long, and I will. And we have personal experience with that, okay? So when we start losing the labor that we've depended on for 20 or 30 years because we can't get our political act together to have a system that allows people to come in legally to help us take care of our agricultural needs, shame on us. I mean, that is really disgusting that we cannot find a way to put something on the table that allows us, that's in our best interest. That is in our best interest. And someday when we start seeing higher prices and vegetables or fruits that are grown somewhere outside the United States that have pesticides used that we don't have an idea what they are or how much. I mean, we are really staring at an issue that is so blatant and so obvious, and we cannot get our act together to take care of it. I mean, that is really pathetic. I'm serious, because you talk to those farmers today that are losing their farms because they cannot get the labor to do what they need. We don't worry that much about that when we're growing corn and soybeans in, you know, Nebraska or Illinois, but it's a huge part of the agricultural industry, and it's going to affect that entire system, and that's another thing I worry about. I was trying to end it on a positive note.
You did. Well, there are so many things that Howard could have been doing today, and he elected to come and join us for a few minutes, and I hope you feel great about that as an organization. Please join me in thanking him.
It's farm broadcaster Max Armstrong. He spoke with Howard G. Buffett of the Howard G. Buffett Foundation during this year's National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention held in Kansas City during the month of November. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.